So, today we are going to finally start talking about some properly non-classical logic after this long introduction on classical proposition of calculus. And the first major system or a family of systems that we are going to talk about are modal logics. So, they appear, we will not have even opportunity to talk or even mention all of the possible applications or places where they appear or reappear, were invented or reinvented in computer science earlier. Maybe let's just say that they can be appearing in various aspects of theoretical computer science. But also in other areas, for example, linguistics, even social sciences. Economy. One could even argue that in some areas of mathematics, but this wouldn't be your most mainstream mathematics one. So, and we will only cover some of the applications here. Before we start suggesting where one can possibly use those formalism, maybe let's explain briefly what is the main idea behind them. One should also mention that they really emerged from philosophy. So this is in fact where, just like logic in general. So this is in fact where people start first looking at modal systems, modal formalism. So there are at least two possible stories by which one can use to introduce the subject. So one would be semantic and another would be syntactic, let's say. This is not very standard way of describing it, but so the semantic story will be that we want to have some lightweight formalism to talk about transition structures. To specify reason about transition structures. And the syntactic story would be simply that we want to introduce some new connectives to the supply of those basic connectives of classical propositional logic that we have seen so far, so conjunction, implication, bottom, well, negation equals implication to bottom. Something which, unlike in case of predicate logic, does not necessarily have fancy binding issues like quantifiers and whatnot. So something which still remains on the propositional level, but it cannot be characterized anymore by simply truth and false tables, right? Because this was the only semantic that we really needed so far. So the syntactic story would be extending CPL with new propositional connectives. It can be one, it can be more. Which cannot be characterized just by truth and by just ordinary truth tables. So the simplest possible setup, and the setup which we are going to spend most of our time on, is when we have just one single unary such connective, and possibly some other things that can be syntactically defined from it, like you can define, let's say, disjunction from negation and conjunction, or top using negation and bottom, and so on and so on. Simplest possible setup, basic modal logic or basic modal signature, single unary connective. Call it box. When actually you can find all sorts of notations for all sorts of modalities, but this one is probably most common. And just as a remark, for the time being at least, there are systems where you have whole algebra. There are systems where you have n-ary modalities, and then there are systems where you have whole algebras of where modalities themselves form a separate structure where you can form sums of modalities, possible intersection of modalities, transitive closures of modalities, and so on and so on. So, in applications, one often considers much richer supply of modalities, possibly equipped with some algebraic structure. For example, sums, intersections are not so common. Converses, transitive closures of modalities. But this is something that is only going to concern us much later, if we get there at all. So if we have enough time, we will try to discuss one such formalism, so-called propositional dynamic logic, which is particularly natural from computer science point of view. Before we get there, though, we first, of course, want to understand how ordinary modal logic with just one simple plain box works. But before I start giving you syntax, is there something I forgot? No. Before I start giving you syntax, maybe it's actually useful to think of possible readings of this language. Because what such a thing box 5 would possibly mean? So Phi is necessary to. This is the old philosophical one. Another one is would be phi holds after each execution step of program or process, each possible execution step. A very similar one would be phi holds after each execution of the program, which is of course not exactly the same because execution can consist of possibly many steps. And these readings will be central to these applications in propositional dynamic logic, but there would be many other ones. For example, some fixed agent, for example, myself, knows that phi. Yet another one would be that phi is obligatory. This would be so-called deontic reading, which is common when you want to formalize legal reasoning, for example, and stuff like this. Which one of all the other possible readings I should mention? Agent or a coalition of agents can force. So this is reading common in logic of agents. It will always, another reading would be temporal, so it will always be the case that phi. There is, of course, way to use it. Use this modality to talk about past, and that would be that phi has always been the case since the beginning of the world. Okay, so this is just a small selection of all the readings, and I'm not making this up right now. I mean, all these possible applications of modalities have not just papers, but sometimes conferences, books, monographs devoted to it. As I said, for us, only some of this would be important or relevant, or we can only cover so much in those 4 or 5 lectures that we have. So, maybe we can start with some kind of general intuition or principles that something like this should satisfy. So, at least for this box-like notation, I always most of the time, at least, I was going for something saying that it always, after each, it is necessary to. Actually, maybe let's make it more specific what it means. For philosophers, this means that phi holds in each possible world. So again, we have some kind of universal quantification here. I don't want even to start discussing what those possible worlds are philosophically, and if you into Leibniz or whoever, then you can read up on this, but this is not really important for us. What matters is that in all of these instances, we are talking about something which is holding general. So this box phi has a... there's one more important reading that I wanted to mention, which on the surface, at least, does not seem to mention any kind of universal quantifier, rather the existential one. So box phi in mathematics would be that phi can be proved. In some sufficiently rich system like Zermelo-Frankel set theory or piano arithmetics. So that would mean that there exists a proof that phi. But still, this has to do with validity, just like here you have something stronger than just being accidentally true, right? So, what are principles that, in general, such a connective should satisfy? Maybe let's write it for timing as intuition, because we have no semantics, no proof system so far, so we have no way of proving this. But such a connective for most of those readings should satisfy propositional variants of laws governing universal quantification in first order logic. What could be good examples of such laws? Do you remember some axioms or rules that we have for a universal quantifier? For example, is it rational to expect that phi implies box phi? Is it true that phi implies for all x phi? If this, maybe not in all of those readings, this is, but this is intuitively a stronger statement than phi. Just phi saying that phi happens to be true, but this box phi says something that it has to necessarily be true. Always, after each execution, in each possible time flows, after no matter how many steps you make. I mean, not all of those readings are exactly like this, but this is a general trend. So, in general, this is not very likely, something like this is not very likely to be low for that would be universally valid. It can happen for some very special models or very special interpretations, but we don't want this kind of things to be basic axiom. Whereas on the other hand, something like this is looking much better, right? Do you remember what were the laws for governing the interaction of universal quantification and conjunction? If you have for all x, phi and psi, it was exactly the same as saying that for all x, phi is true, and for all x, psi is true. This is how those things should look like. Compare another example would be distribution over implication. Of course, by distribution this time I don't mean equivalence, but just unidirectional. And again, this looks very much like the law we have for universal quantification. If you have that for all x phi implies psi, then it should be the case that if you have for all x phi, you also have for all x psi. This comes not true. Of course, one has to be a bit careful if you give all these possible motivations, because then it may happen that at least for some of those readings, this kind of laws could be dodgy. Think of this one, for example. It depends, of course, what you mean by knowledge. Again, philosophers were arguing about this for millennia. The most common definition in philosophy is that knowledge is justified through belief. But if you look at this belief part, then even if you happen to know that phi, and if you happen to know that psi, mathematically or logically you should be also be aware or be able to deduce that phi and psi, but somehow we don't always add two and two and make four. Right? So it may happen that we know phi and we know that psi, but do not necessarily know that phi and psi. Also with this coalition of agents, this is actually more of a realistic example. It may be the case that, and this is happening all the time in politics, even on university level, right? If you're involved in university parliament or whatever, it may happen that you may form sufficient coalition, that there is some coalition of parties or fractions which can force phi, and you'll be able to find some coalition or parties or fractions that can force psi, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you will be able to find a coalition of people who will have enough majority, enough votes, enough power to force that both phi and psi holds. Such is life. So maybe let's just make that make an observation that for some of those readings, especially epistemic means knowing that, so maybe let me write it as a remark. This is agency, this was deontic, and actually, you know, even if you look at deontic, let's hope that our law is consistent enough, but we know that it's actually very crappy, whatever country you are talking about. So it might very well be the case that even the things that are postulated or forced by law are not necessarily closed under logical rules. But anyway, this is something that we don't want to discuss here. So for some of those things, especially epistemic or agency, such axioms would be questionable at best. And modal logicians study systems without them. For a general framework to study such systems, you can go, of course, to Professor Schroeder's seminar on algebraic logic. Being so-called algebraic modal logics. Another typical area where you want to be a bit careful with some of those basic axioms, it's probability. I mean, the probabilistic applications of modal logic are also where algebraic modal logics tend to shine. But these are not the readings that we'll be concerned with. Right? We are much more interested in things like talking about transition structure, state space of a program, possibly temporal readings that things will hold after, no matter how many steps in the future you will make. Yes, do you have a question?
Yes. Are we able to do box by spy?
Sorry?
Just by those readings, I think the rule box by plus spy, like the one above, but
box
the other direction would be reasonable.
There is another rule. It is a very reasonable rule for most of those readings, but now actually it's very good. We are already in the right mood to discuss formally what is valid and what is not. So now we can introduce semantics and try to see semantically what, for example, whether or not we can expect for which possible kind of structures we could expect that box phi implies phi. So enough with this long introduction and motivation. We can do some math, let's say. So for timing, I didn't. These were just intuitions. I didn't give you proper axiomatization, although it's very close to axiomatization, minimal axiomatization, is the one most important of that. Instead of, however, starting with some Hilbert or Gensen system, and of course we will do Gensen systems today, we rather start with semantic definition. So let's say that a pair, first of all, we should give formally definition of what we call modal formulas. So, sorry again, I'm not going to follow the rule that the atoms start from A. For me, they will start from P, Q, and R. I hope that this will not confuse anybody. So, but be prepared that, especially when the other lecture takes over, they may switch to A again. And then we form conjunctions, negations, top, bottom, which one was primitive for CTL in this lecture? Bottom? For classical propositional logic? Bottom, okay, whatever. And box phi, this is the new one. So all of this you know from CTL. Okay, so this is our syntax. And a pair where R is subset of the Cartesian power of W. I mean, those letters may look a bit random, but I'm trying to follow most common notations in most modal logic references. So a pair like this is called relational, let's say, but we don't usually need to mention this. Transition structure or Kripke frame. Why Kripke? Because Saul Kripke was a young genius, young at the end of 1950s, where he, there were ideas of giving similar semantics for modal logic before, but he gave it in the most succinct, perfect version that we know today. Right, and now a mapping pi, and now I'm deviating again from conventions that we had in CTL case, where we were using kappas for valuations. Now we are using letter pi. What was the notation for atoms? Was Luz using atoms or variable or var? Atoms, right? Atoms. Okay. So we For us, now valuations will be mappings which send atoms to subset of our critical structure, the critical frame universe. And quite often, we say that a model is something which consists of, quite often the notation for Kripke structures is calligraphic F, and well, it's a different kind of calligraphy, and for models M. Consists of universe, a set of possible worlds, state space, that would be more scientific way of describing this, binary accessibility relation of it, and evaluation. So now we want to say when a formula is true in such a model, and a new thing compared to what we have in classical propositional logic, and even actually in the predicate case, is that we are only giving such definition relatively to a given point. You have to first choose a word or a state in this state space, and only then you can say whether a formula is true or not. So, inductive satisfaction definition. We say that a given word in a model satisfies atom P if, well, this is actually easy to guess, if the word belongs to the denotation of this proposition. Sorry? Oh, is that? Okay. Better? Well, this is again easy to guess. I mean, what could it be? So this is very common when you have well-defined semantics that formal, connective in logic, and you've seen it even when introducing, for example, semantics of CTL, of perceptual logic in Gloin, that the logical connective, like and, is translated into normal linguistic or meta system and. And that's what it is. So the interesting, negation also. Should be straightforward. If it is not the case that and this is often written as again, here in model logic these two things are the same. In future, we will see for other than classical logics that we are going to talk about in forthcoming weeks and months, it might be the case that this and this thing are not necessarily the same. Yes, Miriam, why do you look so puzzled?
Is it omega?
This is W, sorry.
W, what is it?
I should have written clearly that W is just one of the points of the state space, a well, a possible well. In general, when I would write small W's, V's, and so on, I would intend them to range over elements of this. Sorry, so this was indeed confusing me, if it wasn't clear what this means. Okay, but the definitions themselves look rather trivial, right? So you may wonder where is the catch. Some of you already probably know it, especially those who took other courses like communications and parallel processes, because nothing new is happening here. But let us let the cat out of the bag. So given all these possible intuitions that I gave you, what could this possibly be? We want to scan all accessible states, worlds that are possible relative to the present one. So we're saying that if for all V such that V can be accessed from W, it is the case that it should not be P, sorry, I want to define it, of course, for arbitrary formulas, not just atoms. So, you see now that there is indeed some universal quantification here, but it's very restricted kind of universal quantification. Compared to the ordinary universal quantification of first order logic, we are not scanning the whole state space, all possible worlds, numbers, individuals, whatever our W consists of. We are only looking at those that can be somehow accessed, made transition to, which are possible relative from the point of view of this guy. Whatever, how you want to read this R depends on which of the application of, which application of modal logic you have in mind. And now, of course, we have, and I forgot bottom. Sorry. But this, of course, is not much of surprise. So now, of course, we want to make sure that we have the right satisfaction clauses for the right collectives. And if deriving of clauses for implication and disjunction as exercise, I guess it's not going to be too problematic. What is more interesting is, I said that there is that this thing, this box, can be seen as a kind of universal quantification. So there should be some kind of existential quantification, right? And you remember that in classical logic, you could define one from the other. So what if we define now diamond phi as, so define also diamond phi as not box, not phi. You remember what was happening with existential quantification, right? Compare exist x phi as, no, for it is not true that for all x. Well, first of all, what would that mean? At least some of those readings. It is not the case that box not phi. How would you read it? Okay, maybe let's not start with philosophical looking like stuff. This is a bit more concrete, right? So if it is not the case that not phi holds after each possible execution step, what am I saying in other words? Yes?
There might be an execution step, but it doesn't hold.
So doesn't hold? So remember that we have one more negation here. It is not the case that not phi holds after each possible execution step. Or maybe let's look at the temporal reading. It is not that It is not that it will be always true that not phi. It's rather a roundabout way of saying that yes, negations are puzzling, especially if you stack them, but what could that be? There is much simpler way of saying the same thing.
There is a case for that phi true?
It will always be the case. Maybe it's not a very easy to read way of saying that in all future instances it will be the case that phi is true. So if it is not that in all future instances not phi will be true, there will be some time in future, some moment, some instant where phi will hold. Similarly, we were here already very close to the red reading. After some execution step, phi will hold. How about this one, actually? If it is not obligatory that non-phi, it means that well, I'm saying it obligatory, so you know it's a law. Thou shall not kill. Not kill, for example. Thou shalt not steal. So you have here some example of some negations which is obligatory. So if I'm saying that this is not the case that thou shall not kill or that thou shall not steal, it means that it's permitted to kill and steal, for example, during the war or whatever. So that this would mean that diamond phi is permissible. Or, I mean, that there are all these jokes about differences between Germany and United States and whether everything that is forbidden, that is not explicitly permitted is forbidden, everything that is explicitly not forbidden is permitted, and so on and so on. Or for this one, if it cannot be proved that not phi, this is actually a mathematical one, so it may be. That would mean that phi is consistent. Right? That assuming this, adding it as an axiom or as an additional theorem to our theory, does not immediately lead to provable inconsistency. Okay, let's not go into this because we're not going to go into arithmetical interpretation from modal logic, but. This is where it's going. So now can you work out the satisfaction clause for this? Anybody can give me. And it should be just a matter of transforming, straightforward propositional transformation of what I wrote here. What would that be? Tell me. Help me out. Exactly.
Such that there is a relation to W and phi holds.
Exactly. So phi holds in some successor. And this is something that we can and we should formally prove. I leave the details of this derivation, which is really just a matter of negating the universal quantifier to you. Okay, so now we could prove a bunch of other easy theorems. For example, a very standard one is that, which you would expect also, given what we know about valuation even in classical propositional logic, is that only those items which are actually occurring in the formula matter. So if you have two different valuations which agree on all the atoms appearing at phi, they have to do the same thing to it in any point in our model. Again, I don't want to spend too much time on trivial exercises. So let's just write it and leave it for you. So, exercise. Give inductive definition of the set of atoms occurring in a given formula. And show that any two valuations agreeing on all such atoms satisfy phi, so I have to add phi, so occurring in a given formula phi, and show that any two valuations agreeing on all such atoms satisfy phi in exactly the same points, states, words, however you want to call them. Concludes that formulas with no atoms do not need valuations, do not need valuations to establish the satisfiability or satisfaction at a given point. Or validity at a given point. Okay, so this is exercise you can do for yourself. And the more interesting question is whether I'm saying anything meaningful here. Right? So are there any interesting variable-free formulas at all? So far, we just had top and bottom. So if you start writing boxes and diamonds, which are just abbreviations for negating box knots, can you suddenly obtain more strange variable-free formulas which can be true in some places, false in some other places? And where would that be? So let's say that, okay, let's start playing around with simple examples. So how simple it should be. Let's say I have universe 0, 1, 2, and accessibility relation, let's say R1, maybe I would want to have more universes and more accessibility relations later on, but more domains. But for that, let's start with just a single one. And let's say that I'm just making 0 related to 1 and 1 related to 2. And I'm not even forming a parasitic closure. Right? So this is important because some of those readings are clearly hinting at transitive reading on modality. And indeed, quite often you want it to be transitive. But there is nothing in the definition, either in the definition of what critical structure is or in the definition of satisfaction, which somehow scans transitive closure on any relation. So let's say that, so this is 0, this is 1, this is 2. And let's say that I make, sometimes I will make a mistake, and instead of writing pi, write v, because this is for valuation, because these are the two most common way of writing valuations in literature. Either people write it as pi, small pi, or capital V. I try to be consistent, and remind me if I get it wrong. So let's say that one is a single point where pi holds. So can you tell me, and maybe let's write a convention, maybe let's write the semantics brackets phi for the set of those points in our structure which make phi true. So can you tell me, I mean, for p itself we already see it, right? What is the denotation of p? Can you tell me what is the denotation of box p? Maybe I should write some prefix here, so, not prefix, sorry, subscript. What is this? What is the set of points that are making box type? Box, sorry. Of course, you can answer this question. I have to be more precise. So, where does box P go? Actually, maybe let's make it more complicated. No, let's not make it more complicated. Let's start with simple stuff. So, is there any point where box P holds? Yes. Ah, I'm suggesting. So is there any other one?
It also holds at two.
Exactly. Again, we have instance of the phenomenon that we have seen already, or I hinted at during the CPL lectures, that universal quantification over an empty set is trivially true. So now, when we're looking at this point two, we are universally quantifying over the set of all its successors, and this guy is empty. So this means indeed that box P has to be true there as well. By the way, how would it be with box bot then? What is the set of points where box bottom is? Is there any such point? I mean, you already have that, yes? Of course. So everything, the point is that with this definition of satisfaction for a box, by exactly the same argument, if I write this inconsistent, absurd formula following box, if you have no successor whatsoever, then any formula prefixed with box will be true in at such a point. How about diamond bot? Does it have any chance of being true somewhere? We have worked out the clause for
time on.
So can there exist a successor of some point where this will be true? No. So this is empty, and it will always be empty, whatever kind of structures. So, of course, then this must be this is the negation of it, right? So this thing must be the whole public. And this again will be always. What are other lessons in here? So here actually, funnily enough, we see a situation where P implies box P, right? P is true at one, where box P does not hold. So neither P implies box P, nor box P implies P. Yeah. Actually, the domains of box P and P are disjoint. The notations of box P and P are disjoint. Which is funny, but apparently it can happen. Of course, it will not always happen, and also, we didn't talk about diamond P, so where is diamond P? So this is the structure. Put it up for a second. Is there any point which has a successor where P is true?
Yes? Null and
zero. No, okay. Yes. So here the domain of, and this is a bit more So this is also a bit strange, because here we have that diamond P is true in less cases, or in less, it implies box P, but not the other way around. And again, if you think of box as a kind of universal quantification and diamond as a kind of existential quantification, this is not what you would always expect. So this is a bit strange structure. I only use it to show that in general, variable free formulas can behave in a way different that you would expect, at least when you write box in front of something false. Rather than playing around with more examples, maybe I will leave it for you as exercise. I should introduce more notation. Maybe let me add it somewhere here. Maybe then first define this notation. So let's say that formula phi holds in the whole model if for all W, so this is global satisfiability. Global is all possible. Well, and it's true in the frame. So remember, this guy comes with evaluation. And this guy comes without valuation. If for all pi, we have f pi makes pi to everywhere. And finally, phi is valid. If as you may guess, for all f 5 holes of f. Maybe one more point that is worth mentioning, because you may see it in various references in modal logic, is that there can be some controversy which symbol to use. But I'm personally not very much in favor of using this one. If you're really pedantic mathematically, then you want to use the analogy with forcing. I don't know who has seen some lectures in set theory or have heard about forcing in set theory, but one way of reading this sign, especially when you have a concrete world, would be that a given world forces pi. So the notation for notation used in mathematics for forcing is this. So I would prefer to use this notation for a relation between structures and formulas, and to keep this relation, this notation, for relation between sets of formulas or lists of formulas and individual formulas. So that would be a kind of semantic consequence. Alternatively, one can of course write this sign with various lengths of those dashes, but this is not very easy to pull off if you're not very calligraphic, and as you notice, I'm very, very bad calligrapher. So anyway, this is probably most common notation, and I would expect that Professor Scherer will be also using it, so I stick to it. It's just that don't be surprised that if you see rather this notation in some very standard books on this topic. Okay, so far so good. So we may now formulate another exercise. Show that the formulas that we wanted to be true everywhere are indeed universality. Maybe let me also write or mention that the set of all the valid formulas is what is normally called minimal modal logic K. K, of course, for Kripke, the guy who gave us Kripke semantics. It's the minimal normal. By normal, one normally means that this kind of axioms hold. So probably whatever axiomatization, Gensen system or whatever for K you'd like to find, you would either want one of those things as axioms, or you would want to show that those things are derivable. But we have already seen that not necessarily all the formulas that one would expect to be universally valid are universally valid. So we have already seen that this is not true. Or maybe let me write that this thing does not belong to K, so that we have some opportunity to get accustomed to its name. We have also seen that box phi implies diamond phi does not belong to K. And we could actually draw more conclusions even from this very simple example that that we have seen here. But let me not jump ahead too quickly. Maybe as one more exercise. We will see which one will make it to the blood and which one won't. Show that box does not distribute over this junction. Which is not something that you'll expect, right? And if you think of universal, if you think of universal quantification, for all x, phi or psi does not mean that we have for all x phi necessarily, or for all x we have psi. But as it was already justly pointed out, there are some additional rules that we would like to be true in for at least some of the standard readings of modality. And it might be the case that if you introduce some corresponding condition on the accessibility relation, you would be able to force it. So here, for example, we did not have that box P implies P. Do you have any insight why the axiom, which was already postulated, right? We have already suggestion that box phi should imply phi. Why, even in this stupid simple example, we couldn't get it? What was the feature of accessibility relation which made it false? Is there some additional postulate that we can give which will ensure that box phi will behave a little bit more like universal quantification should behave? So what box phi was saying was that phi is true in all successors. And just phi is saying that phi is true right here. So if box phi fails to imply phi, it means that the very present state, this moment, this world, is not a successor of itself. Right? So what could be the condition on this binary relation that we could impose to make sure that box phi implies phi is true? Yes? Exactly. And we can even state it as below. Everybody knows what reflexivity is, right? So for all x, we had that Rxx. Actually, I said theorem, but it's again too easy to waste our time on. It's yet another good exercise. So. Well, we are covering a lot of material this way. But you have the idea, right? How a proof should look like. Any ideas about... Okay, let's start from the other end. So now I started with an axiom and we somehow work out a condition which was... which made this axiom sound or valid. How about if I start from the other end and I impose some condition on my accessibility relation and I want it to be forced by some axiom. For example, transitivity. If I want R to be transitive, what is the kind of axiom that I could write to make it true? Well, this is maybe less straightforward than reflexivity. In particular, the axiom will look syntactically a bit more complicated. Come on, it's easy. Well, no, I'm overselling it a bit. Maybe it's easier to think in terms of diamond. If you write this axiom in terms of diamond, of course, it's smarter than the straightforward propositional manipulation. It would probably waste a few more minutes. It's something that you can see, but well, we would need to build intuitions for a minute or two. So we will leave it for later, what transitivity could correspond to. But now we already have pretty rich picture. We know that there are some formulas which are universally valid, some which are not. We also know that some of natural-looking formulas were justified from the point of view of most standard readings of modality corresponds to some natural conditions on accessibility relation. So one thing that we are still missing in the picture is some truth-preserving operations or on models or relations between those models. And the most central one, which a few of you could have seen in other lectures that we are offering as well, is by simulation. This is such a central notion that it keeps popping over and over. And actually, it's one of the greatest gifts of monologic to computer science. It was the notion of bisimulation was invented by several people in different contexts, and there is one can have long argument where it appeared for the really first time, but definitely modal logic is one of the earliest sources, and this is also one of those areas where some of the most theoretically interesting results about bisimulation as well. So, given models and n, which is of the form ES, no? And the relation, let's say Z or E, whatever is more common notation, between the universes. Let's say that Z is bisimulation. If the following three conditions hold. For every WB, if W is equal to V by this relation, then for any P in the set of A terms, P is satisfied at W if and only if it is satisfied at the point to which W is related by this simulation. So this is preservation of or invariance of propositional atoms. More interesting ones are conditions which, even though you don't see it on the surface, will actually ensure that the simulations play well with all modal formulas. So first connective called fourth, condition called fourth. If you have that W is related by the simulation relation to V, but also it has a successor W prime, then there exists V prime such that V is related to V prime and W prime is related by this simulation relation. In pictures, you could draw it like this. So here you have some R successor of W and some V simulation partner or whatever of
V. Actually, this one is given. Then there must be something on this side which is similar to the successor of W. And well, even in the name you have this bi, so there must be some symmetry here. And the back condition is saying, as you can probably imagine, that something similar happens also on the other side. So if you have W, V, and V prime, such that this V prime is here, the successor of V, then there exists W prime, such that W prime, and these guys are the same. So again, in pictures, you could draw it as so, yet another exercise will be now to show basic result about bisimulations. Given M, N, Z as above, for any W, small W in capital W, and V in capital V, and for any phi, a model formula. Actually, we didn't introduce any good notation for the set of model formulas. We have that model formula phi is satisfied at point W if and only if it is satisfied at point phi. Shall I leave it again as an exercise? Maybe before we prove it, let us have an example. We already had one model consisting of 0, 1, and 2.
You should perhaps think as part of the theorem that V and W should be
of course. It should have been self-explanatory, but of course it is horrible that I forgot to write. Yes. Thanks, you saved. Save us from certain disaster. So you remember the model that we had before, 0, 1, 2. Now let me draw something slightly different. A, B, C, D. And I'm going to make P through here and here. Are those two guys B similar? Will you be able to find some relation like this, which satisfies this back and forth condition, results the variables, and any proposals? So first of all, do you believe that they are dissimilar or not? We say that two models are dissimilar. Maybe I should have said it as part of definition. If there is some dissimulation relation. Well, actually, it doesn't really make much sense if I talk about whole models, unless you're talking about global dissimulation. So a pair consisting of a model and a point in it can be dissimilar to another model and a point in it. So we are really talking about pointed models. So are those two guys dissimilar? We will be able to find a relation that is relating this 0 and A in such a way that all those conditions are satisfied. Maybe let me add that we say whenever there is a dissimulation relating W and V, we say they are bisimilar. And we write it as M W is bisimilar to M. These kind of guys are called pointed models sometimes. Model with a distinguished point. So any proposal? So do you believe that 0 and A are bisimilar? Who is voting for yes? Anybody voting for no? Anybody in the excluded middle? Well, actually, most people are in the excluded middle. But okay, so if you believe, then you must have some grounds to believe so. So I already said 0 and A should be related. What I'm going to do next? What shall I relate 1 to? It's a pity that we don't have colorful chalk right now. Miriam, you look very skeptical. What was that? Did I write something funny? Or? It is very possible that I wrote something funny, but.
I don't know. Is it small W or?
Small W. And small V. Pointed model consists of a model and a small point, one single word restating. So what I'm trying to show now is, if this W here is 0 and this V here is A, then we have such a beast. Still something? Maybe I should write very clearly that normally we can, of course, write explicitly the name for the dissimulation relation relating to these two guys. But in fact, as it turns out, there is if there is such a dissimulation relation, there is always the greatest one. So it makes sense to make this notation not less specific, dropping the name of the dissimulation, the concrete dissimulation relation, witnessing this fact. Okay, so what shall I relate 1 to? Because we are already coming to the end of our time. It should not be hard, come on. You believe that this is true, so you must have some good reason for that.
since we can go from 0 to 1, and P holds at 1, we need to find a successor of A such that P holds there. We have two choices, so let's relate A to relate it to B.
Okay.
So 1 to B. And now, so that's the fourth condition, and with the back condition, we know that since we can go from A to C, we need to relate it to something on the left side. The only possible candidate is 1. That's the only thing that...
Right. So 1 has to be related to 2 things, precisely. And then...
Well, and then you can see by a similar argument that 2 and D should be related.
Exactly. Well, this is looking horrible because we don't have colorful chalk. Maybe if I wrote this as fat arrows, it would be, and with very clear heads, it will be a bit easier. Next time I will bring colorful chalk from our resources. Yes, so, I mean, I leave it to you to verify that this is a simulation relation, and then the theorem we can either leave as exercise again or prove it during tutorial session. We have by now already quite a lot of material for tutorials as well. So here is where we have to stop right now, and we continue tomorrow.